Hello, I'm Peter Martin from The Economy Stupid. It's your guide to the world of business, buying and decision making, and what it means for your mortgage, your job, your rent, and what you can afford. Because the economy isn't just out there, it's in here. It's in what we do. Search for The Economy Stupid and hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, a royal eviction. King Charles strips his brother, Prince Andrew, of his remaining titles and boots him from his royal residence.
He will have to pay his own way from this point on.
That's a British MP who's been pushing for increased powers to remove royal titles. You'll find out what questions she still has about the King's decision. Then,
the council has agreed to the bill without amendment.
This is an amazing moment. So the legislation creates the Galang Wall, which essentially resets the relationship between First Peoples and the government.
Landmark news out of Victoria's Parliament as the state becomes Australia's first to legislate a treaty with Indigenous Australians. Plus, we'll get the latest on Donald Trump's meeting with Xi Jinping in South Korea. Hear from a cabinet minister about a critical minerals summit in Canada, and we'll cover off the week in federal politics with our Friday political panel. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Sally Sarah already had a smorgasbord of stories ready to serve up this morning on Radio National Breakfast when this bombshell dropped. Just as we started the show, we learnt that King Charles was removing the titles of his younger brother, Andrew, formerly Prince Andrew. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, as he'll now be known, wasn't just losing his honorifics, also his residency at the Royal Lodge, a home he's lived in for almost a quarter of a century. It follows years of questions surrounding his relationship with the late convicted child sex offender, Jeffrey Epstein, and allegations that he'd abused the late Virginia Giuffre when she was a teenager, just 17 years old, allegations Andrew has long denied. So within minutes of the news breaking, our executive producer, Eleni Soltis, hit the phones and she called up Rachel Maskell. She's an independent MP in the UK, who until just months ago was actually a government MP, but she was recently suspended from the Labour Party. Last week, she filed a motion in the British Parliament to increase powers to strip royals of their titles. As we were racing towards the news, Eleni got her on the line for a couple minutes, and Rachel told Sally just what she made of this development.
Well, obviously, it's breaking news. We saw scenes this week when King Charles was walking in Lichfield, in a city in the UK, and he was heckled really badly about his brother. Clearly, he's been reflecting on the implications of this and all that it means, and I'm glad to see some movement. Of course, reading the statement, we need far more detail. It would seem that Andrew is still technically the Duke of York until processes have been completed, and I understand from the research I've undertaken is that there will need to be permission from Parliament to give the powers to the King to remove the titles, and I published my bill to enable that on Monday.
And what do you make of this in the statement saying that Andrew will move from his Royal Lodge residence into, quote, private accommodation? What does that mean?
Again, we need to understand the details of this, but clearly the privileges of office and title is being taken and being stripped from him, and that he will no longer be at a peppercorn rent, which means he's living virtually rent-free and in a grace and favour property. He will have to pay his own way from this point on, and therefore to see what alternatives mean, we'll have to see whether or not that is somewhere within the grounds of Windsor, or if this goes far beyond that. So I think there's a clear indication of direction, although clearly there will need to be a timeline wrapped around this so we really do understand what is happening at the centre of the royal family.
How much do you think the release of this memoir by the late Virginia Dufresne, who was a victim of some of the sexual acts allegedly by Jeffrey Epstein, and also says she was abused by Prince Andrew, which he denies, how much has this accelerated all of that?
Well, clearly there has been a focus after there were greater revelations within the book. I guess there has been serious scrutiny within the royal household. Of course, we don't know all of the facts there, but what I would continue to say is that the victims and survivors need the thoughts of us all, and the fact of the horror that surrounded the Epstein empire has ricocheted across the world. Clearly, there is a need to really understand the extent of the abuse that occurred.
Rachel Maskell there, an independent MP in the British Parliament, speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. And you can keep following the story across ABC platforms today. Let's turn to other stories making news. And this one, which broke late last night out of the Victorian Parliament.
The bill will be returned to the Assembly with a message informing them that the Council has agreed to the bill without amendment.
That is the sound of Victoria becoming the first state to enshrine a treaty with its first peoples. The bill gives greater powers to elected Aboriginal representatives and allows the community to have a say on the issues that affect them. Reuben Berg is a Gunditjmara man and co-chair of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria. He was there last night as the bill was passed, and he joined Sally this morning.
How significant is this?
This is an amazing moment for First Peoples, an amazing moment for Victoria, and an amazing moment for Australia.
And what will it mean for Indigenous people in Victoria?
So the legislation creates the Galang Wal, which essentially resets the relationship between First Peoples and the government and will enable us to deliver practical solutions at a local level to get better outcomes for our communities.
And how will that representation work?
We have the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, which is a democratically elected group of traditional owners from across the state, and that will continue under this Galang Wal. And that will enable our community leaders to speak directly to the leaders of the government.
According to the Premier, Jacinta Allen, the treaty will give Indigenous communities the power to shape the policies and services that affect their lives. In your view, what policies and services should be the priority right now?
Well, we're very fortunate that here in Victoria we've had a four-year Yurok Royal Commission that has investigated what are the key things that need to be addressed. And there's 146 recommendations that we want to be looking to implement here in Victoria to actually get those better outcomes.
Is there any momentum, Reuben, for similar legislation in other parts of the country?
I would hope so. We've been trying to make sure that we can demonstrate here in Victoria that this is possible, that this can be achieved, and hopefully that gives hope and inspiration for other jurisdictions to take a similar path.
What have been the lessons of this process, do you think?
A key lesson from my perspective has been the importance of bringing our community along for this journey and making sure we've got a shared aspiration, but also making sure that we take little steps along the way, that we haven't tried to achieve this all at once. There's been really significant milestones, and this moment is another one of those really key significant milestones.
Victoria will hold a state election next year. The Victorian Liberals have vowed to scrap the treaty agreement if elected. Are you concerned that it could be under threat?
Well, we continue to have open conversations with all sides of government, and we're confident that now that this legislation has passed, we can start implementing this and people will see the success that this process will bring.
Reuben Berg, a Gunditjmara man and co-chair for the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, marking that news that Victoria has become the first Australian state to enshrine a treaty with its First Peoples. Heading back overseas, because US President Donald Trump and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping have taken steps to de-escalate their trade war following a meeting held at an international airport in South Korea. The meeting went for 40 minutes, and as you're about to hear, Mr. Trump said it went very, very well. The US is now set to reduce some tariffs on Chinese imports, and there'll also be a pause in Beijing's new restrictions on rare earth minerals and magnets, also a resumption of its purchase of American soybeans. Back in the day, Dennis Wilder was a CIA official who held high-ranking positions at the National Security Council. He's seen as a leading expert on China. So Sally asked him for his assessment of the meeting.
Well, first of all, it's a pause in the trade war. It isn't the end of the trade war. There are plenty of unresolved issues, and there were some broad agreements But the devil is always in the details. And what we're getting right now is the broad outline without understanding really what the detailed commitments are on both sides.
President Trump said that on a scale from 1 to 10, he would rate this meeting as a 12. Are you as optimistic as the president?
I think I'm a little more cautiously optimistic. I do think it was a positive meeting. I think it does signal an end of the very intense, back and forth between the United States and China, at least for a little while. What will happen now is Treasury Secretary Bessent and his counterpart, Hali Feng, will have to fill in the details.
The rare earth minerals was a major pressure point that had caused alarm in global supply chains. How significant is it that China has agreed to suspend its proposed export controls for a year?
It's extremely important because China really controls about 90% of the world's rare earth production. And so I think the Chinese overreached recently, frankly, when they announced these new broad restrictions, which were not just pointed at the United States, but were pointed at the whole world. This really shocked people. China had to call a meeting in Beijing with 140 foreign representatives to try and walk it back a little bit. But we are all dependent on Chinese rare earths. And the ability we have to get off of that is a long-term project, not an immediate 1 or 2 year project. Now, Australia has signed a new agreement with the United States. We're working with Canada. We're doing our own work in Wyoming. There's a lot being done to try and get off the Chinese supply chain. But for the moment, the dependency is very great.
Does it in any way dilute or diminish the critical minerals deal between Australia and the United States?
No, because this is a national security issue. This is not just an economic issue. We cannot, as the free world, allow China to have that kind of chokehold on us. And the only way to get rid of that chokehold is doing our own mining and reprocessing. It isn't a question that the rare earths aren't available around the world. They certainly are. But it was cheaper and easier to do it in China. But what we find is it now becomes a national security problem because we can't build fighter aircraft, we can't build tanks, we can't build all kinds of military equipment without these rare earths. So we cannot allow ourselves to be held hostage by the Chinese over and over again on this issue.
But what did President Xi get out of this meeting, do you think?
He got a lot. The lowering of tariffs, they've gone down from 57% to about 46%. He got a place at the world table of equality to Trump. There was a very interesting statement by Trump saying this was a G2 meeting. Well, that's a concept the Chinese love, of the United States and China being the two great powers working together on the world's problems.
Dennis Wilder there, a professor at Georgetown University. He's also a leading expert on China and a former CIA official who held high-ranking positions at the National Security Council. Well, last week, Australia and the US signed a multi-billion dollar critical minerals deal. It was designed to combat China's global dominance in the market. We wanted to know what these discussions between the US and China meant for Australia, so we lined up Madeleine King, the Minister for Resources. She's currently in Toronto, meeting ministers from G7 countries on critical minerals, and she told Sally the government's view on Trump's talks with Xi.
Well, firstly, it is good news. It is good news that the two leaders of the world's two leading economies have met and have had a productive meeting and have reached some concessions around the export bans on rare earths and critical minerals. And I think at any moment, it's good for Australia that there is more open and free trade, and we welcome that, of course we do. But what we know is the imposition of these export restrictions were arbitrary in nature, and equally the lifting of them is also arbitrary based on a single meeting. So it still behoves us to make sure we do develop a separate supply chain, and I know we've been working on this for some time, knowing that That is a vulnerability in the system when you have all of these products coming from one country. And that is why I'm in here in Canada at the moment talking with ministers from G7 countries about making sure there is a more resilient global supply chain of critical minerals and rare earths.
Tell me about the discussions you've been having with those G7 countries. Are there new markets for Australia in the export and or processing of critical minerals?
There certainly are. And I mean, some of these markets, obviously, we work with already, Japan in particular, and of course, the US through a recent announcement of the US-Australia Critical Minerals Framework. Increasingly, there's opportunities for Canada and Australia to work together, both great resources nations with opportunities in mining, but also refining of critical minerals and rare earths. So we are working with it. We're not part of the G7, but we've been invited to be part of this forum. And I think that reflects recognition by the G7 and the importance of Australia's resources sector into the global supply chain of critical minerals and rare earths. So it's a good opportunity for us to participate in this meeting.
As you're saying, Australia signed an MOU with the European Union in 2024 to cooperate on critical minerals. Is there a further more detailed deal to be done, similar to the one with the US?
There's no doubt we will be in discussions with the European Union as a whole, but equally with their individual members that are part of the G7, France, Germany and Italy. And I've had discussions on the sidelines of this G7 meeting today. There's a lot of interest that the German government has a raw materials fund, as does the French government, and they want to invest in projects in Australia, and we welcome that investment. It just adds to the strength of our sector and the strength of those global supply chains. So I do expect there'll be more arrangements, investments, and therefore outcomes for the Australian people and more Australian jobs in regions right around the country.
Moving to the EPBC back home, the government introduced the environmental approval reforms to the Parliament yesterday. The bill will allow the Environment Minister to override environmental guidelines on the grounds of national interest. Under the draft laws, would a critical minerals project be considered in the national interest?
There's no doubt under the reforms it could be, but, you know, that would have to be a matter for the time and the situation and the project itself. I wouldn't want to anticipate any decision of that nature. I mean, it rests in the words itself in the legislation that would have to be, as you've described, in the national interest. So any defence-based project could be one of those. But, you know, I would be just speculating and it'd be a very rare moment in the use of that power of the minister in any event.
So critical minerals projects could be blocked under this legislation. There's not an automatic approval.
No, of course not. Of course not. And every project is taken on its merits for the whole approval system, but certainly in the use of that particular power, you know, even more so, it would be a very particular and rare moment where those powers would be used, but they would be because of national security and national interest matters.
Does the government need to be more explicit and specify with legislation or regulation on what is not a reason for overriding the laws?
Well, I think that would be too prescriptive on any minister on any given day when ministers that make these decisions or have these decisions put before them. It would be at a moment and in a circumstance of intense national interest. So to prescribe what that may or may not be just would only seek to curtail the operation of executive government.
You were just listening to the Minister for Resources, Madeleine King, speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. Well, let's stay with the government's environmental law reforms with our Friday political panel. Phil Khoury, the political editor at the Australian Financial Review, joined Karen Middleton, a political columnist with The Monthly, and our very own Melissa Clark, Radio National Breakfast's political correspondent. Sally started by asking Phil about whether the government's confidence in passing this legislation should be warranted.
Oh, it took a bit of a hit late yesterday, Sally, when the Senate voted, the non-Labor parties voted to kick it to a Senate inquiry, which won't report until March next year, so that it's very unusual for a bill to pass while it's still being inquired into, so it looks like this may now drag over the summer and into the new year. It is a really important piece of legislation. As Ken Henry said, earlier this year. It is the most single most important productivity measure this country needs, is to fix that broken EPBC Act, because it's abjectly failing both the environment and the business side of it. From what it sounds like, the minister's sort of put together a fairly good compromise, but it's at the start of that process, the edict was both sides have to give, and at this stage both sides are standing their ground prepared not to give much. So it'll be a wrangle over the next few months, I suspect, unless something shifts that we're not aware of and they could still jam it through before Parliament rises.
Karen, the impossible question, who's it more likely to be the dance partner here, the Greens or the Coalition?
Well, I suppose there's arguments in favour of both and against both for the government. I think they possibly would prefer to do a deal with the Coalition.
Buy-in later?
Well, yes, and the distancing from the Greens, and they've historically had a sort of irritation with the Greens, and the Greens sort of declaring that they had the biggest block in the Senate and they were going to have the power, etc. So the government doesn't mind slapping them about a little occasionally and just saying, look, we don't entirely need you all the time. But it's not a done deal yet. I know the minister was courageously saying, oh, well, everyone's unhappy, so we must have got it right.
Covers no one backs it.
Good try, that's right. I think you'd rather everyone was happy. That's not going to happen either. So there's a ways to go, yeah. As Phil says, now there's this inquiry extended to March next year. That makes it much harder for the government.
Mel, what's the political situation for the Coalition here? Is it the best political decision for them to compromise and be inside the tent here?
Look, for the Coalition, there's definitely a lot of pressure here. The business community wants a deal and would prefer a deal done with the Coalition. So in the advice that they're taking from the business sector, there's certainly pressure there to make sure that they are part of the game. The problem for the Coalition is there's not necessarily the same level of unity within the party about what's the best outcome compared to, say, the Greens, where if you're at least negotiating with the Greens, you can be pretty confident the whole team can be on the same page. Susan Lee doesn't really have that luxury at this point because this issue intersects with so many other elements. I can see Phil getting ready to bust in.
But I think
the Coalition is under pressure to do the deal, but it's a difficult one for Susan Lee to do because of the party.
And it is emblematic because Lee, as Environment Minister, commissioned Graham Samuel 5 years ago to review the Act and come up with these recommended changes, which are more or less reflected in the bill. So Lee's got a buy-in there, and it's a perfect opportunity for her as leader of the Liberal Party after that massive loss to make good on that pledge to sort of bring them back to the centre and be a bit more cooperative. And this is a classic opportunity.
And a chance for her to demonstrate that she's got the leadership chops to bring everyone together.
When Watt sort of earlier this week or late last week, the initial noises from the Coalition were favourable, and then they hardened their stance, I guess, due to the Minerals Council and the BCA and some of the National Party and others got in their ear. So I think it would be good for Lee optically to be able to land this thing for the Coalition. But as Mel said, it's more the internals and the lobbying that's probably the problem. But they're closer to a deal with the Greens than the Coalition on this. They don't have to give so much to get the Greens on side, and they will do it if they have to. They're not going to be held to ransom on this, and that's something that the business community and the Coalition need to be mindful of.
Phil Currie there, ending the Friday political panel, along with Karen Middleton and Mel Clark. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap. Every interview was presented by Sally Sara and produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team. You can catch the radio program every weekday morning from 5:30 a.m. on the wireless and also on the ABC Listen app. And you can catch The Breakfast Wrap a little time after that, either on Radio National or also on your favourite podcast platform. Today's edition was produced by Josie Asher. As always, our executive producer and occasional breaking news guest wrangler is Eleni Salters. I'm Lixidam Dunton. I'll see you same time, same place next week.